Welcome to the TWIML AI Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Charrington.
Did you miss TWIMLCon AI platforms? If so, you'll definitely want to check out our TWIMLCon video packages. Featuring over 25 sessions discussing expert perspectives on ML and AI at scale and in production, you'll hear from industry leaders such as Facebook, Levi's, Zappos, and more about their experiences automating, accelerating, and scaling machine learning and AI. In each video package, you'll receive our keynote interviews, the exclusive team teardown panels featuring Airbnb and SurveyMonkey, case studies, and more. Over 13 hours of footage. Once again, visit twimlcon.com/videos for more information or to secure your advanced purchase today.
Alrighty, everyone, I am on the line with Xavier Amatrian. Xavier is the co-founder and CTO of Curai. Xavier, welcome back to the TWIML AI podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Sam.
So for those that don't recognize the name, Xavier was actually our third guest after switching to the interview format. So this was over 3 years ago, and so much has happened for both of us. We last had an opportunity to catch up at the AWS Remars conference. When was that? Back in June or so? And I thought it makes sense to get Xavier back on the show to get a little bit of an update as to what he's been up to. So when we last spoke to Xavier, he was leading the engineering team at Quora, doing a ton of work on recommendation systems and other machine learning use cases. Prior to that, he led the machine learning algorithms team at Netflix. And again, he's currently the co-founder of Curai, a startup in the healthcare AI space. Xavier, why don't we just jump right in and have you bring us up to date on Curai and what you're up to there?
Sure. So Curai, we are using state-of-the-art AI and machine learning for a very big and bold mission, which is to basically bring the world's best healthcare to everyone. And of course, that is, as I said, a very bold and very big mission. And we are making it concrete by basically focusing first on primary care. So we want to bring the cost down of providing good, not good, but best quality healthcare to everyone by using AI and machine learning to bring it down to a place where it can be affordable and it can be scalable. And everyone in the world who has a phone can have sort of like primary care in a very convenient, accessible, and affordable way.
And so when you're talking about allowing people to use their phones for primary care, are we talking about like turning your phone into a tricorder, or are we talking about using your phone as a kind of a vehicle for accessing human physicians, or something in between, or something totally different?
it's a combination of the above, and plus something slightly different. But the realization is that, you know, a lot of what can be solved in primary care in healthcare, it really boils down to having conversations between patients and physicians, and of course providing input to those conversations from different sensors and labs and other places, right? But the core of what happens in any kind of like medical visit is a conversation between the patient and the doctor, and that's the part that can be really automated, and not only automated, but actually brought to a point where it's you can do it from anywhere that you have a phone with any kind of connection, and you can start having a conversation and chatting with a doctor. That's all you need. And of course, there's always going to be things that you can do over the phone. Like, you can get your medication over the phone, right? But that's okay, because we can always deliver medication to your home, or we can always refer you to a lab that is nearby and get the result from the lab and whatnot. But the really key issue, and the part that we're focusing on, is in that conversation that happens between patients and doctors. And we have a service where we employ physicians to basically be on the other end of the line to have those conversations. And what we're doing is applying this AI machine learning approaches to automate as much as possible this conversation, so we can augment and scale the doctors. So an important piece here is we're not replacing the doctors with the AI and machine learning. What we're making them is we're giving them, I usually say we're giving them superpowers, that instead of being able to see, say, 100 patients a day, they'll be able to see 10,000 of the conversations, and most of the easy stuff will be handled by the AI and machine learning, and they'll be able to focus only in the places that they're needed the most.
Is 100 patients a day a typical metric for a practicing physician?
It really depends. In primary care, the numbers are roughly about, the average is, I think, 12 minutes per patient. So you can, it depends on what the working hours are for doctors. That's actually, that's in the U.S.
Okay.
There are other places like India, for example, where it's much less than that. And doctors can see way more than 100 patients in a day. And the reality is that they're not even seeing them. The nurses are taking care of them before they get to see the doctor, but they count as having seen the doctor. So it's, but you can, obviously you can imagine that a doctor with 15 minutes or less to see a patient and to remember, first of all, the history of the patient, what's going on, ask the right questions, get the right answers, remember everything they know about medical school and come up with a diagnosis and come up with a recommendation, it's really hard for any human being to do that at that rate, right? And of course, there's a lot of mistakes and a lot of things that happen because of this. What we're trying to do is say, hey, hand that off as much as possible to the algorithms and the machines, and then make sure that when the doctor comes in, they come at the right time, and they come at the point where they have all that information laid out for them, and they can verify the decisions and make sure that they're saying the right thing. And at the same time, that's what we mean by augmenting, right, the doctors. We are, of course, giving them information that is state-of-the-art and based on real science, and they can get that information in a way that they can parse it and they can say, okay, yeah, this is the right decision, I agree, instead of sort of like having to deal with all the messiness of gathering that information, parsing it, remembering things, going through the electronic health record, and then making a decision, all of that in less than 15 minutes, right?
Now, there are aspects of this that sound very much like, you know, from the kind of technology I'd expect to see, like other conversational agents, where you've got some back-end resource or team that you want to optimize the use of their time and allow some AI system to handle the kind of easy responses. I've got to imagine that, you know, things get a lot more complicated and messier, different, certainly more important in the healthcare side of things. Can you talk about some of the unique challenges associated with applying this kind of technology in healthcare?
Yeah. Definitely. There's a lot of challenges, and you're right. You could think that the typical approach to dialogue systems and all the advances that we're having recently on this kind of chatbots and things like transformers and BERT and GPT-2s and things like that are useful, and they are. I mean, we are using all of the above in different ways. But the reality is, in a domain like healthcare and medicine, where the stakes are so high, you cannot leave things out to chance or just to a model to rely on this kinds of conversations to actually following the right path. And there's a lot of examples out there where you can trick any of these models to say things that seem reasonable for any human being, but they're medically completely wrong, right? And there's been a few examples of that. And of course, that's the key issue that we were tackling with is like, how do we combine prior knowledge about what's correct and incorrect in science and in medicine with some of this automation, right? We do have a key insight here, and a very important thing of what we're doing is we control the end-to-end. So we have both sides of the conversation, meaning the patient and the expert, the doctor, right, in this case. So the interesting thing in the way that we're applying this technology is that we can deploy the conversation helpers in both ways, right? We can decide to serve something directly to the user if we want to, but we can also serve it to the doctor, and the doctor can use it as an assistant and make a call whether that makes sense or not, if it's being helpful, right? That's a really important thing, right? Because then you're basically walking the line between a chatbot and an assistant, kind of like a Gmail assistant, if you will, when you get an auto response suggestion, right? Mm-hmm. And the doctor can decide, okay, yeah, this makes sense. I'll just take it as it is, or this doesn't make sense. But they're still sort of like making sure that that's medically correct. And at the same time, we are getting training data on how our model, the model that we're building, are accurate or not, and in what way they are or not. We have actually an upcoming publication in one of the workshops of NeurIPS, which basically talked about this, how to constrain the flexibility of this sort of like deep neural dialogue systems with expert feedback in order to make sure that the information is accurate for a domain, particularly in medicine in this case. So we need to combine the best of both worlds. And by the way, we do the same thing in other parts of our modeling strategies, like diagnosis. In diagnosis, we're also combining expert systems, which is old school AI, with deep learning. And I think you cannot rely 100% on any of the two, but you can get much better if you combine those two strategies in some smart ways, which I think it's a key insight for medicine, but it's also something that will happen, and it's being advocated for by many people in machine learning in general, right? It's like you can't blindly trust models that come only from the data with no prior knowledge or some form of knowledge constraints. And a lot of people are trying to figure out, like, how do you combine those two things, right? How do you combine all the power you get from models that are basically just being trained from lots and lots of data with knowledge that we have, and structuring that knowledge in some form of prior into the models?
Right, right. That is a theme that continues to recur here on the podcast and in my conversations. One interesting thought there is, certainly on the probabilistic side, we've benefited from a huge recent explosion in available tools and, algorithms and the like. You've mentioned a bunch of those already, BERT, et cetera. And, we've got tools like TensorFlow and PyTorch and many, many, many others. Whereas expert systems, we think of as kind of a throwback to pre-winter, AI. And I can't think of, not being deep in that space, I can't think of kind of what the leading open source expert system software might be. Is there a tools ecosystem there, or is it, are people building, when people have this realization that they need both and not one or the other, are they kind of building it from scratch?
I don't think there is such a thing. I don't think there is a, you know, there's a next per system component for TensorFlow or PyTorch.
Or should there be? Does that make sense? You know, would something like that have benefited you, or is it, you know, is it basic? It basically just kind of rules that we know how to code them because, you know, it's not probabilistic.
Not really. I mean, and by the way, they can be probabilistic, right? At the end of the day, what you have with these expert systems is a graph, and then you can do probabilistic inference on the graph, and you can do different things on that graph. So mm-hmm. basically, I'm thinking a generic tool for expert systems would be rather simple in the sense that all you need is a way to represent sort of like graphs and make inferences on those graphs. So it wouldn't be that complicated to sort of like have a component for TensorFlow or for PyTorch that basically does that for you. So the key thing here is those expert systems rely a lot still on sort of like manual labor. And just to give you an example, in the case of some of the expert systems we're using some that have been developed for over 50 years, right? So there's a couple of expert systems for medical diagnosis that go back 50 years, and we're using both of them actually. And interestingly, you know, there's a lot of knowledge in there, right? You can think about, you know, 50 years of a bunch of hundreds of really well-trained physicians encoding knowledge and information about medicine in a graph, right? Mm-hmm. And that's really valuable. And it's really something that if you can then inject it into any learning system, you get a lot from it, right? To your question, there is no, you know, there's no tooling for that. On the other hand, you can do interesting things like one of the things we've done is use this expert system as basically a data generator to generate synthetic data and train deep learning models from the data that is generated from the expert system, right? That's an example of something that I think is very useful and really, really valuable because then you can even merge synthetic data with natural data and you can tweak it in ways that you can learn a model that actually now has some prior knowledge that has been injected in the form of ground truth data, so to speak.
Can you speak to that particular point in a little bit more detail?
Yeah, sure. Okay, so in this case, the thought process was like that, right? Like we know that, you know, if we have very good data and we train a deep learning neural net, we could get sort of like a really high accurate diagnosis system. The reality is that high quality data does not exist. If you go to electronic health records, which we have used ourselves, I mean, we have a project with Stanford where we have been working with them on using the electronic health records. And this has been something that others have done, like Google and DeepMind, and you name it. It's like learning predictive models from electronic health records. Electronic health records, the data quality is really, really poor.
Notoriously so.
Yes, yes. And there's a lot of reason for it. But one of it is, you know, they weren't designed for the purpose of diagnosis. They were designed for the purpose of billing and to make sure the insurance companies got their money back. So there's a ton of issues with them. But again, that data is valuable. It's not like it's totally noise. There is something in it. So how can you generate some kind of data that is more you know, solid and sort of like can treat more as a ground truth? Well, you can go to this expert system, which again, they are is, you know, a graph, and you can start activating nodes and generate data from that graph that basically becomes sort of other cases that you use to train your deep learning model. And that's what we showed in this is a paper we published last year where we basically generated data from the expert system. We injected noise to that data because an interesting and important thing is you want to train a model that is robust to noise, right? The problem with expert systems, one of the problems, is that they're not capable of dealing with noise. So in other words, if the patient doesn't say exactly the symptom they have and they make a mistake because they didn't understand the question, or the doctor enters a wrong thing, the expert system is basically doomed, and it was going to give you an incorrect output. That's not the case for, you can train machine learning models that are, relatively robust to noise, because you can even do adversarial training and you can do a lot of different things to make them robust. So how do you combine both? Well, you can also inject noise to the expert system. And that's basically what we did. So we generated data from the expert system. We injected different kinds of noise. One example, which I think will be very obvious, is you can inject noise by saying, hey, I'm just going to randomly inject symptoms that are very common, right? I'll just add coughing to everything because, coughing is something that people have in general, no matter whether they have one disease or not, right? It's like it's mm-hmm. you always can cough or sneeze or something like that that is very prevalent and very common. Is a typical thing and can really confuse an expert system. But it's if you train a machine learning model on ignoring cough because it's something that is very common and it's not very it's not going to help determine what the diagnosis is. Well, then you build a robust model. So we again generated synthetic data from these systems, injected noise in ways that we made the learned model more robust, and we also combined that synthetic data with natural data that we had from EHRs and other sources to also prove that you don't need to constrain yourself to just one single kind of data, right? All you need to do is combine it in smart ways to sort of like understand because there's obviously value to training from real world data. All you need to do is figure out how to combine it with more clean data and data that you can trust.
You mentioned this kind of injecting noise via adding symptoms that are frequently recurring. What are some other examples of the kind of noise that you're injecting? And then more broadly, how do you quantify the value of this synthetic data in building out your models?
Yeah. To the first question, I mean, I think that the key insight to adding noise in a domain like medicine is that you need to have some domain knowledge, right? Like when I gave you the example of adding symptoms that are very common, that makes sense, right? Because it makes sense because we know about medicine. Like, okay, yeah, the explanation makes sense. Another example is like, well, you can remove symptoms that are very rare or are likely to be missed, right? That's another thing that makes sense once you explain it, right? But you need to have some insight and you need to talk to doctors. And that's something we do all the time, right? This kind of strategies don't come up by, sheer imagination. They come up because we talk to our physicians and we talk to them and say, hey, how do you deal with these issues? What are issues that are common and that lead to mistakes in diagnosis? How can we make sure that our model doesn't make the same mistake? So I think that is a key an important thing is you need to work with domain experts. And that leads me to answer your second question.
And let me just pause there because that's a kind of an interesting point. I think, when I think of noise, at least from a classical engineering perspective, I think of noise as like this junk that's, uncorrelated from your signal. But what you're suggesting is that at least when you're creating synthetic data, your noise needs to be correlated with your actual noise that you need to expect. You can't just have, purely random noise because that won't help your model.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, here it's a slightly different, right, notion of noise, if you will. But what you have is synthetic data that is strictly true, if you will, because true in a scientific sense, because it's been generated by kind of like an expert system that it's been designed on science. But what you need to do is inject noise that mimics more the reality of nature, right? And mm-hmm. the messiness, right? But that noise, yeah, needs to model some of the natural messiness that you see in real life. and you need to not inject it. Yeah, it's not white noise in that sense.
Right.
It's noise that tries to turn that synthetic data into something that is more real, right? If you think about it, I mean, I use sometimes the metaphor of like the self-driving cars also use synthetic data that is generated from video games. And it's like, well, you can imagine that you are training your self-driving model on data from Grand Theft Auto, but you need to inject, I don't know, fog, and you need to inject rain, and you need to inject things that are not maybe, you know, in your synthetic data, and they're adding noise to the capture of the image, but in a way that mimics real live situations, right? Not just white noise.
Mm-hmm. In that sense, it's a bit like the concept of domain adaptation.
Yeah, I mean, you could consider it that for sure. And that's another, it is a very important, I mean, domain adaptation in itself, I mean, we could go into that. It's another important thing that you need to do in many cases because, and yeah, you're right. It could be seen as that, right? Because sometimes you are training on ideal data, but then you're going to be faced with real life data that it's going to have to be interpreted in the context of the ideal data that you use for training. So yeah, it is. Yeah.
And, okay, so you were about to take on that second question.
Yeah, the second question was about how do you even know that the data is good or even the model that you're training is good
and beyond that, the relative advantage of, you know, how do you compare with and without using the synthetic data? You know, is it a training time or is it a, you know, accuracy or some combination of all these things?
It's mostly about accuracy, right? And the problem is that the definition of the accuracy is, again, really tricky and not that obvious, right? Accuracy in the context of medical diagnosis is a very, very tricky thing to define, particularly because you would hope that by asking a physician, you would get a ground truth. But that's not the case, right? There's studies out there, for example, the Human DX project that published some studies that on their data set, the average accuracy of a single physician was 60%, right? Which is really low. Now, if you take the consensus of 20 physicians, that got up to over 80%, which is much better. But then, of course, you need to have 20 physicians agree, and you're still at 80%.
Which is a lot better, but not necessarily comforting if you're the patient.
Exactly. And I think that's a key issue in, like, what do we treat as ground truth? So in our case, we use a combination of a lot of things. We use a combination of sort of like publicly known data sets, which there's not that many, unfortunately, for this domain. And they're just, a few what's called medical vignettes that you can use to evaluate. We also use our own physicians to QA, and we make sure that we have sort of like several of them agreeing on the cases, so we know that we're right. And then at the end, there's also this kind of like synthetic data, right? It's like you need to treat that synthetic data as pseudo ground truth, in the sense that, as I mentioned, if you think about it, that synthetic data is the result of, as I said before, 50 years of research from hundreds of physicians who have agreed that that's what that particular disease should be defined as, and that's those are the symptoms that are related. So it's as good as a ground truth as you can get in many other cases, right? So again, I wish I had a great answer for this, but the reality is I don't. It's like it's kind of an iterative process where you like treat one data as a ground truth, but then you compare it to your other data. You let your physicians go through it and say, yeah, this is correct or this is not. And then you feed it back and you keep improving both over time. And I think that's another very important lesson learned here is that you need to design all these systems as really learning systems, right? So it's not only about what's their accuracy today, it's more about how can you make sure that the accuracy and all the other metrics you care about improve over time, right? And in the meantime, the important thing is, like, we always default to humans, right? It's like, we'll always default to a human doctor and improve the model over time, and just tell that human doctor, like, hey, our model thinks that these three things are important. Do you want to consider them? And the doctor will say yes or no, and it's their call. We'll be as good as the doctors are. But over time, we are pretty sure. Actually, even in our offline evaluation metrics, we think that our models are already at least as good, if not better, than the average doctor. But even with that, it's not enough, right? It's like they need to be better than the best doctor to even make it feasible to rely on them. But they're a good assistant and a good augmentation to the human physicians, for sure.
Have you made any attempts to benchmark the third party expert systems with regard to, you know, some elusive metric around accuracy I guess that the thought is that, you know, even if we were confident that each of the elements in this expert system, you know, was vetted by the 20 doctors or whatever required to, you know, have a consensus that, you know, has some sufficient level of accuracy, you know, medical perspectives have changed significantly over 50 years. I don't know the extent to which this is tracked in this expert system, but, you know, there are diagnostic practices that apply not equally across different groups of patients. So you have all the potential for all kinds of biases within a data set like that. Have you made any attempt at kind of evaluating that?
I mean, we are constantly evaluating that with our data, but it's really hard to come up with something that I would dare to publish, right? Because it's the problem is the same. It's like there is no ground truth. There's a couple of papers on evaluating different systems and different online symptom checkers, and those are the ones that everyone is using as sort of like the benchmark. And there's a paper by Semigram on evaluating symptom checkers, and there's some medical vignettes that she published, which are commonly used by a bunch of people, including some like Babylon in the UK and so on, where they publish things like, well, we use these vignettes because that's all we have that at least is commonly available and you can benchmark against.
Yeah.
But they're far from, you know, something that it's you could consider sort of like has good coverage of medical conditions and you can trust as being comparable. But that being said, again, I think that the reality is, as harsh as it may sound, it's not too hard to be better than the average physician. But again, that's not enough. That's not convincing. Like if I told you, like, oh, I can build a self-driving car that is better than the average teenage driver, would you be okay? Like, well, probably not.
It's like, right.
Because the average teenage driver is not somebody I would trust on an automated driving machine. So I think here it's pretty much the same. It's not about being better than the average doctor. It's about being better than the best doctor and being able to augment and always sort of like fall back on humans. And I think that's exactly, I like that comparison to self-driving cars a lot, because I think what we're trying to build is not a completely autonomous vehicle, right? What we're trying to build is AI automation as an assistant to the driver, just like many cars do right now. But in this case, the driver is an expert who is a physician.
One more question for you. You mentioned earlier that among the techniques that you're relying on, you do make some use of transformers, BERT, GPT-2, that kind of thing. How does that play out in what you're building?
That plays out in many different ways. I mean, there's a lot of great things about those approaches. The one that I think is probably the most relevant in our case is the fact that it's all about transfer learning, right? It's mm-hmm. about if you have a great model that has learned in general how to speak, sort of say, you can then fine tune it on some specific domain to become better about speaking about healthcare, right? So a lot of the approaches we take is we look at some of these models, we fine tune them on very specific data that we have that is focused on healthcare, and then we can use it to do a bunch of things. I mean, the output of those models can be used in the context of a chatbot or a dialogue system, but you can also use them to generate features for anything, for a classifier or you name it, right? And I think they build a representation of language in general, right? So mm-hmm. so we use them as inputs to many of the things we do, but more directly we also use them as I was mentioning before to generate assistance to the physicians as they're chatting and they're talking to the patient, right? So if you think about, and that's also, I think, I dare to say, pretty common in many applications of just customer service in general, like where customer service will have sort of like assistance. Actually, there are some papers, I think, for example, from Airbnb, where they've done similar things for their customer service, where there's basically an assistant that is telling the customer service and suggesting things they could say so they can basically accept them or not and decide whether they want to type them out or just simply select the suggested response. So that's an example where you can almost, you know, you can take one of these models, fine tune it, train it on very specific data that it's more healthcare oriented, and you can generate sort of like an assistant for a physician or an expert in any given domain.
Well, Xavier, it was absolutely wonderful catching up with you. Really excited to learn more about what you're up to there at Curi, and I'll definitely be following along.
Okay, yeah, great. I would say that many of these things that we've have mentioned, we are publishing, and we are we have, I think, 4 papers in this machine learning for healthcare workshop in NeurIPS. And if people are interested in following up on some of the details of how we use this transformer models or how do we do diagnosis and so on, that's all. I mean, they can go to archive and find more details on some of this techniques and how we're using them and trying to solve sort of like this huge healthcare problem access. So, yeah.
Fantastic. We'll include some links to those papers on archive in the show notes.
Great. So great talking to you.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. To learn more about today's show, visit twimmelai.com/shows. Once again, if you missed TwimmelCon or want to share what you learned with your team, be sure to visit twimmelcon.com/videos for more information about TwimmelCon video packages. Thanks so much for listening. Peace.